Welcome to this Forthright Radio for February 1st, 2017. We have a very full show for you today, if not quite the show I had planned. As late as yesterday, for example, I had expected to inform you that, quote, the Army is now accepting your comments on the Dakota Access Pipeline. You have till February 20th to make your voices heard, end of quote. Well, since yesterday, the acting Secretary of the Army has directed the Army Corps of Engineers to grant the easement necessary to finish the billion-dollar project. Well, with us to discuss the rapidly changing political landscape is Michael Tanglis, who is a senior researcher with Public Citizens Congress Watch Division, where he produces data-driven reports on a wide range of issues. Most recently, he researched corporate ties and conflicts of interest in the Trump's cabinet nominees. Prior to joining Public Citizen, Michael Tanglis worked as the lawyer at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, where he managed a project investigating the epidemic of foreclosure rescue fraud in the wake of the housing collapse. As a leading expert on the issue, he published reports on consumer complaint trends and worked directly with law enforcement to shut down scamming operations around the country. And with fewer than 24 hours' notice, he joins us from Public Citizen's office in Washington, D.C. Michael Tanglis, we welcome you to Forthright Radio.
Thank you very much for having me, Joy.
Michael, even as we speak, things are rapidly unfolding in Congress. Yesterday, the Democrats took the unusual, perhaps unprecedented step of boycotting the Senate Finance Committee to prevent the nominees for Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and Health and Human Services Tom Price from moving to the full Senate for a vote. Then, just an hour or two ago, Senate Republicans took the equally unprecedented step of suspending the rules of the committee, which require that at least one member of the minority party be present for the panel to vote in order to send a nominee to the Senate floor. This morning, with the committee rules suspended and with only the 14 Republicans in the room, they voted to move the Mnuchin and Price nominations to the full Senate. Why did every Democratic member take that unprecedented step of boycotting the Finance Committee of these two nominees for these 2 days?
Sure. I think the first thing is, you know, we've seen throughout the testimony of the various nominees that Democrats have not exactly been fans of all of Trump's potential nominees. But these two, Price and Mnuchin, which is HHS and Treasury, are different because what's going on now is they've actually found instances with Representative Price where they feel that he may or may not be involved in some insider trading of healthcare stocks. So that's obviously something of great concern to people. If he's going to run the Human Health and Services Department, if he has been using insider information and also been giving special deals on healthcare stocks, and then in turn presenting legislation that would help that same company where he had just bought the discounted stocks, that's something that I think is very important to them. And I think what you're finding is they weren't getting the answers that they wanted, and they just wanted to move along with the process. So Democrats picked these two nominees because they felt it was time to pump the brakes on it until they got the proper answers. Now, with Mnuchin and Treasury, what they found is that some of his testimony has turned out to be they're accusing him of lying, essentially, where he's saying that when he was running this bank, One West, he was not involved, or there was no involvement in robo-signing. So there's been basically a mountain of evidence to show that's not exactly true. And when they asked for answers from Mnuchin, he sort of dug in his heels and said, you know, we weren't involved in this and things like that. So really what's happening is Democrats have reached, it seems like, a tipping point with these two specific nominees because they think there are really, really huge concerns with both of them, and they haven't gotten the answers that they wanted. So instead of moving forward until they got their answers, they decided to boycott it.
Mm-hmm. And also about an hour ago, the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee delayed a vote on Representative Mike Mulvaney's nomination to be White House Budget Director, with a vote now likely tomorrow. Senator Claire McCaskill said she wanted more time to review the FBI background check on the South Carolina Republican, which she said was late in arriving. And she wanted the members of the committee to have the ability to thoroughly digest and perhaps even question him. What can you tell us about his appointment, nomination, I should say, as White House Budget Director?
So he is somebody who, this most recent one that you had just mentioned about the FBI background check, I hadn't heard yet. The bigger issue that came up with him, or the most recent issue that came up with him, is he actually had not paid taxes on a nanny that he had in his house for a number of years. So he had a nanny working in his house. He has triplets. That nanny was essentially a full-time worker in his house, 40 hours a week, but he didn't report it to the IRS. So that came out in the hearings, which is basically he had to pay back about $15,000. But the broader issue with Mulvaney is he seems to be someone who doesn't actually believe that the government should function in a normal way. So he's one of the Freedom Caucus members in the House, which basically he said he was all for shutting down the government. He thought shutting down the government was good policy and good politics. He threatened to defund the government. He threatened to shut down the government in order to defund Planned Parenthood. So he's someone who has really been on the far right of a lot of issues, and specifically with some of the things that President Trump ran on, which included protecting social programs like Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security. Mick Mulvaney has called Social Security a Ponzi scheme. He's been for raising the retirement age in the Social Security and also raising the retirement age in Medicare and Medicaid. So he's said some things in the past. He's done some things. He gave a speech to the John Birch Society, which is widely known as sort of a hate group and a racist organization that was disavowed by conservatives long ago. So he's really sort of on the far right of the political spectrum. But more importantly, he's really doesn't believe or hasn't seemed to think that government should function in a normal way. He's willing to shut down the government. He's willing to default on the debt. So having him in charge of the budget really doesn't speak well for having a functioning government over the next 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have been focusing on the confirmations. We've just talked very briefly about three of these. Would you do a rundown in the way you prioritize the areas of concern in these cabinet nominations, please?
Well, I mean, it'd be tough to sort of rank them. So we work on certain issue areas and we don't work on others. I mean, we don't typically work on education, but obviously someone like Betsy DeVos is very concerning, just showing her extreme lack of knowledge on the issue of public education. But we don't really rank them like that. I would say the other ones that are of great concern is certainly Scott Pruitt running the EPA. So he's sort of an example of something that we see throughout the Trump administration, and that's nominating people to run agencies when they don't actually believe in the agency's mission. So the most obvious example is someone like Rick Perry running the Department of Energy. Rick Perry famously forgot the Department of Energy, even though he wanted to get rid of it. So when you have someone running an agency that they were more than happy a few years ago to get rid of, it doesn't speak well for them actually accomplishing the mission. And with someone like Pruitt running the EPA, he spent more time suing the EPA than anything else. So he doesn't actually believe in the settled science of climate change. So you have someone like that who's supposed to be protecting our environment at the head of the EPA. It really produces a lot of problems. But really, if you run down the list, there are issues with virtually every nominee that Trump has presented.
Well, let's take a few minutes and run down the list and talk about what public citizens' concerns are.
Mm-hmm. So, well, our concern with Pruitt is that we don't think that he's the right choice to sort of steward the mission of the EPA because he doesn't appear to believe in that mission. You'll find when he was Attorney General, he was typically suing the EPA with groups like Chevron. These are the same agencies that he now has to regulate, which is obviously really troubling that he's sort of been on their side throughout his career, and now he's going to go ahead and supposedly regulate these entities. It's really not a good sign. The other people throughout the cabinet, you know, you have certain people who come from Goldman Sachs. You know, Gary Cohn is one who is coming from Goldman Sachs. He's now going to get about $280 million as sort of a payout in order to go to the government. Trump had constantly said throughout the campaign that he was all about draining the swamp. And he specifically singled out places like Goldman Sachs to say that during the primary he said that Ted Cruz was beholden to Goldman Sachs and they could kind of get him to do whatever they want. And then in the general election he threw that in Hillary Clinton using the speeches that she gave to Goldman Sachs. But he's basically stuffed his cabinet with alums of Goldman Sachs. So in terms of fighting for the little guy, as Trump has constantly claimed that he's going to do, you know, take power away from the government and away from the elites and sort of give it back to the people, he's stuffed his cabinet with billionaires who have proposed policies in the past that are antithetical to what he actually has said he wanted to do in the campaign. Most recently, we have Jeff Sessions at the Department of Justice today, who I believe just passed 11-9 through committee. He's another one who, like Mnuchin and Price, he seems to have sort of at least a generous term would be inflated his record in terms of civil rights, his civil rights history. He had four cases that he presented as sort of these great achievements in defending civil rights. But what we found later on is the attorneys who actually worked on that case came back and said, whoa, this is not, you know, he was not really personally involved with any of these cases that he's bragging about shepherding. So I think in the broad sense, nominee after nominee, our concerns are similar in the sense that we don't believe that a lot of these people believe in the agency, their mission. And that is really troubling when you're talking about protecting health and safety, protecting civil rights, protecting our environment, and with someone like Rick Perry now protecting our nuclear weapons. There's really a lot to be concerned about.
Mm-hmm. Now, Steve Bannon, this is probably going to throw you for a loop, but I want to bring this up. Trump's non-confirmable, doesn't mm-hmm. need to be confirmed, primary seems to be advisor, Steve Bannon, has been quoted as calling himself a Leninist
yep.
in that he wants...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, he went on to say that what he meant by that is, I'll quote him, Lenin, Bannon answered, wanted to destroy the state, and that's my goal too. I want to bring everything crashing down and destroy all of today's establishment. That's the end of the quote. Then the author, Ronald Radosh, says Bannon was employing Lenin's strategy for Tea Party populist goals. He included in that group the Republican and Democratic parties, as well as the traditional press. What is your opinion of that statement? And do you see any relationship between that stated goal of Steve Bannon and the nomination of numerous individuals who have either thwarted the goals of the agencies they are nominated for or actually want to eliminate them?
Yeah, I mean, it's very scary to think about that someone who has said things like that are basically in the ear of the White House, in the ear of the president, and arguably, you know, there's been a Twitter hashtag that's trending about Stop President Bannon, basically saying that he already has sort of great influence over the things that Trump does. But it's a great connection for you to make between Bannon and the cabinet appointees in the sense that, you know, they could be operating or they may end up operating sort of government by sabotage. And what I mean by that is, Republicans have constantly wanted to sort of get rid of the EPA. There's even a congressman who I believe is going to introduce a bill from Florida to actually get rid of the EPA completely. But the irony behind all of it is a lot of these same people have constantly been saying year after year after year that government's so efficient and government doesn't work and it's slow and it's bureaucratic. But then they're going to go into these agencies and without actually believing what the agency does. So of course things are going to go slower. We can't actually believe that they're going to make things more efficient when they don't actually think that the agencies should exist. And the case with Bannon is Bannon, you know, has in the past has seemed to be no fan of people like Paul Ryan and others, like you mentioned. But the idea of sort of tearing everything down and having that, you know, having him whisper in President Trump's ear, I think is really troubling to a lot of people. He's obviously coming from Breitbart, which I'm sure people are aware of. You know, Breitbart, some have described, former Breitbart spokesperson actually described Breitbart is now effectively state-run media. And, you know, they actually were in Bannon's basement here in D.C. That's where they had their headquarters. And we still don't know to this day if Bannon owns any has any stake in Breitbart. What I mean by that is if he owns Breitbart, some portion of Breitbart, and they leak a story from the White House to Breitbart, they publish it, and they get all, you know, all the web traffic and sort of raise their ad revenue. He actually could be self-dealing in that sense. So we don't actually know the details of that because we don't know about all of Breitbart's funders. But as a worldview, it's definitely something that's really concerning to have someone who thinks like that and has said those quotes. I've read those quotes too that you had just said. Someone who thinks like that close to the White House, is really scary.
Well, is there anything you want to add on nominees before we go on to some of the congressional things?
Well, I would say if any of your listeners are, you know, care about some of these nominees and don't think some of them should be approved, you can certainly call your representatives. There is some room. I mean, there with someone like Betsy DeVos, there's some indication that a few Republicans have concerns. I know there are a couple nominees where some Republicans have concerns. So there is, if it's something you're passionate about, you know, you'll see time and time again, the calls that you place to their office can certainly affect them. So they listen to it. And so if this is something you want to get involved in now, they have not all been confirmed yet. So if you're passionate about it, you should get involved and let people know.
And of course, among our listeners are Trump supporters, and that goes for either way of looking at these things. The idea being, be involved, don't just be passive. All right, so there are some areas of concern that I've noted. Among them is the Congressional Review Act, the CRA. Could you please tell our listeners what the Congressional Review Act does?
Sure. So the Congressional Review Act basically gives Congress the ability to repeal any regulations that have been finalized in the prior 60 session days, so days the Senate was in session. And this is what this does is it has a sort of a devastating effect to that particular regulation. So it's only been used once before. It was used when we first had George Bush in 2000. Clinton had passed a rule that had about 10 years in the making. It was a health and safety rule known as the ergonomics rule. And what they did was they basically used the CRA because it had been finalized in the last 60 days. They used the CRA to repeal it. But the devastating effect of the CRA is not only that they get rid of that regulation that has been worked on for a long period of time. It actually prevents an agency from producing a new regulation years down the road, anytime down the road, that is substantially the same as the one that they repealed without approval of the House and the Senate. So it really creates paralysis for that particular agency in that rulemaking process. So once they rip it out, it's not as if things change, they can simply, you know, do a new rule that's similar years down the road if they find that there's something they need to fix. It actually has to be approved by the House and the Senate and the President in order for them to even start work on that regulation again. So it really, really slows down the process. It's only been used once before. It looks like right now It'll be used quite a bit, more than we've ever seen. So it hasn't really been tested in the court, certain aspects of it. So we'll see how that plays out. But we're certainly in uncharted territory because, again, it's only been used on one regulation prior to this. And there's talk now that they're going to use it for quite a few regulations.
Mm-hmm. My source has written, Congress will have 60 legislative working days until sometime in May or June to torpedo Obama administration regulations finalized after June 13th, 2016. Mm-hmm. I certainly wasn't aware of this before researching things for this particular show, and I'm guessing many others are unaware as well. So what suggestions, if any, do you have for our listeners in terms of as conscientious citizens in relationship to the Congressional Review Act?
Well, I think that similar to what I said before, you may have listeners on both sides of the aisle, but if there's a regulation that they're passionate about that they think should be kept, I would encourage them to talk to their representatives. You can look online. We have a website called the Coalition for Sensible Safeguards. And what that'll do is it'll tell you all of the regulations that can be repealed. So as you mentioned, it's 60 days in session. So it's not 60 days. It's only when the Senate is in session, which will bring you back to the June or May timeline. And, you know, really what it boils down to is not so much that getting rid of the regulation. It's the ability to sort of block anything similar without an act of Congress years down the road. So it really, you know, that ergonomics rule that Bill Clinton had passed had, as I said, had been 10 years in the making, and the agency hasn't even attempted to do it since because it hasn't passed through Congress. And it really creates, it doesn't just get rid of a regulation, it can bury it, which is really not good for public health and safety regulations that I think would be of concern for a lot of people. They're looking at some regulations that have to do with consumer finance issues. There are also some health and safety ones. And a lot of these regulations, now what people often say is they're getting rid of these regulations that are rushed out. But time and time again, when you actually look at the regulation, it's been in process for a long time. These major regulations, which is what most of the fights are about, have been in process at the agency for years and years and years. We did an analysis in the middle of last year that looked at about 20 years of regulatory data and found that some of the regulations that are fought about with OSHA and other agencies like that have been in process for 10 years before they were finalized. So it's not really about getting rid of regulations or one specific regulation. It's about sort of throwing a wrench in the whole system, and that's where the follow-up about being unable to enact a similar regulation without the act of Congress really comes into play, because it's really to slow things down to a crawl pace.
We're speaking with Mike Tanglis of Public Citizen. So, Mike, would the decisions of the Keystone XL pipeline for years and years in making, would that come under the Congressional Review Act, or is Trump's executive order sufficient to just undermine that?
I don't believe, I'd have to look at the records. I don't believe that actually came out in sort of through the regulatory process. It's more of Trump's executive order that has sort of that effect. So I don't believe so, but I would have to double check to make sure that wasn't included.
I see. Well, my source on this is the Coalition for Sensible Safeguards, and they say that rules at risk of repeal under the Congressional Review Act include ensuring clean air, clean water, and action on climate change, affordable access to broadband and secure communications, paid sick days for federal workers, that big banks are held accountable when they rip off customers, that workplaces are safe from toxic chemicals, that non-discrimination and fair pay are guaranteed for all. You get the idea that
yeah.
These sorts of things. All right. Is there anything else you want to say about the Congressional Review Act?
Well, I think, and this is one of those things, as I said, that it'll have to play out in the courts in some capacity, because it's only been used once before. This isn't something that has been sort of standard. But it really, you know, the one thing I would say is these regulations that they'll try to repeal, these aren't just sort of snuck out of nowhere. These are really well thought out, well vetted regulations that protect public health and safety, as you ticked off those that list that you had mentioned. You know, things like updating nutrition labels to include a new line for added sugars, right? Things that are going to be good for the public that they've worked on for a long time. They're likely to just rip them out and really prevent them being enacted later on. And it's really sad that one of the first acts of the Congress would be to rip out health and safety regulations under the guise of sort of limiting government. But these are things that are really important that people have fought for a long time, and many of these may cost lives if they rip them out.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of regulations, one of President Trump's campaign promises was that for every regulation, every new regulation, he's going to get rid of two regulations. What can you tell us about that and the potential effects?
So that's one that can really, really be devastating. It's an unworkable situation that he put forward. It's more, I think, to follow through on a campaign promise. You know, during the campaign, he had said he wanted to get rid of 75% of regulations. That's unworkable. Most people kind of know that. Even you know, very conservative-leaning groups or anti-regulation understand that would be a very hard thing to do. But the two-for-one is really, really troubling. And let me give one quick example. So basically, as you mentioned, if an agency wants to put out a new regulation, they have to repeal two of their other regulations. So if you take the example of like U.S. Fish and Wildlife, right? If they find out that a species is in danger of being extinct, the natural thing for that agency to do would be, okay, we need to pass some sort of protection, some sort of regulation to protect this species from going extinct. Now, under this executive order that Donald Trump just signed, what they're going to have to do is in order to enact a new piece of legislation to save that species, they're going to have to look at two other regulations that they have, perhaps protection on other species, and repeal those back. So you're basically going to have agencies looking at, you know, in that one particular example, what species they can sacrifice. It's not that sort of hardline tactic of if you want to put forward one, you have to take off two. Doesn't add any nuance to what's going on. It doesn't look at the reality of the situation out there. It's just not possible. It doesn't work like that. And when you take that example, like the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, it's really, really devastating to think about that you're going to have to sort of, agencies will have to, if they can even get a regulation out, because there's a lot of other bills, as I'm sure you're aware of, that sort of hinder the ability to even get one out. If they do want to get one out, they're going to have to sacrifice something else. And the idea of sacrificing health and safety is really something that I think if people look down at the details of these executive orders, specifically this one, I think for some people they hear, oh, we'll get rid of two regulations to add one, that's great. But if you look at what that actually means and how that can be done in practice, I think a lot of people will be concerned about what that actually means.
Mm-hmm. So there is this thing called the Midnight Rule Relief Act. So tell us about that, Mike Tanglis.
So the Midnight Rule Relief Act is sort of just another one of these anti-regulatory measures that they're constantly talking about. So the Midnight Rule Relief Act is a cleverly named bill the main intent of it is to restrict a president, an outgoing president, of enacting regulations on their way out of office. Now, again, they rely on things like saying that these rules are rushed, and we actually released a report last year on how these midnight rules have actually been under, or the rules that are finalized at the end of administration have been under review longer than rules that are done at any other time. But you see through this, like you see through a lot of these different anti-regulatory measures, it's one thing that they exempt, right? So they under the Midnight Rule Relief Act, the president would not be able to enact a major regulation towards the end of their administration. The bills vary. Sometimes it's the final 3 months. Other variations of the bill say it's 60 days, similar to other anti-regulatory measures. But what they exempt is deregulatory measures. So that's where you see the true colors of legislation like the Midnight Rule Relief Act, because they say, okay, a president can't regulate on their way out of office. But if they want to deregulate, they can deregulate all they want on their way out of office. So you really see it's not about accountability. It's not about proper review. It's about a philosophical difference in that they believe, they don't believe in regulations. Because if they truly thought it was about, you know, protecting and making sure that regulations were smart, they wouldn't exempt deregulatory measures. Because shouldn't you review deregulatory measures? If you're going to deregulate something, right, shouldn't you test and see if it's going to hurt the environment or hurt consumers and things like that? But they don't care about that, as long as they can rip the regulation out. So when you look at it that way, and you look at the just stopping regulations from being enacted and not from deregulatory measures, you see sort of the true intent of these bills. And that same vein sort of works through all these different bills we're talking about in that terms. It's really just about deregulation. There's a lot of other things. There's a lot of phrasing they'll put around it about the true intent. But it's really just about ripping out regulations because they're against regulations.
To be clear, these are not law. These are just proposals, is that correct?
So some of them are mandated by law. Like when you have things like Dodd-Frank, Congress puts these in, they pass a bill like Dodd-Frank. It has certain regulations that have statutory deadlines, which basically means they, with the CFPB is what's most well known from Dodd-Frank, you know, they'll say the CFPB must do this by X date. And then CFPB will put out a regulation that meets that requirement. But the regulations are enacted by the agencies, which is how it's always been. But there's another bill that I think you're familiar with also, the RAINS Act, which would drastically change that too.
Well, let's talk about that. That's the Regulations from the Executive in Need of Scrutiny Act.
Yep. So the RAINS Act, in the most basic sense, what the RAINS Act does is that every major regulation has to be approved by Congress. So whether you're on the right or the left, Republican or Democrat, you certainly are aware that over the past 5, 6, 7 years, things have not exactly been flying through Congress. Now, what they want to do here is run every major regulation through Congress so Congress can approve it. Now, the idea that every sitting representative or senator is going to be able to look at these regulations, right, or say it's an EPA regulation, or it's a CFPB regulation, or something along those lines. The idea that Congress is going to be an issue expert on, you know, different regulations is really crazy. And again, you know, I keep going back to it. The real intent of something like the RAINS Act is that certainly now, with Republicans controlling both chambers, no major regulation could be published without their approval. And it wouldn't be hard to imagine that they don't allow any regulations out. There has been very few that they've been for. So what all of these things are, adding procedural requirements on regulations, the Midnight Rule Relief Act, the RAINS Act, all of these different things are really just about slowing down the process and creating sort of a paralysis, because I don't think anyone would really think that there's a great chance of something getting through with bipartisan support right now. So the idea of if we need to protect our waterways, if we need to protect our children with different regulations, if we need to protect anything that we have to ask Congress to approve of every single regulation. We have scientists who are studying these things, who make it their life's work to understand these sort of different in detailed issues and make decisions off of that. Those are the experts. The idea that we have to put that through Congress, who many of them, and obviously everyone can't be an issue expert on everything, aren't going to be fully aware of what's going on. I mean, we have many members of Congress who don't believe in climate change, so the idea of any sort of environmental regulation getting through is not going to happen. But it really would create sort of a paralysis, and it would also, I think, one thing that's bipartisan agreed upon is that with the amount of money that flows into politics, right, you're going to have all these different groups who are already spending money on elections and, you know, giving different donations to different people. They'd be able to really get in there, and special interests would be able to really get in and throw a wrench in any regulation that would want to come forward.
Some people might be surprised to learn that there is support for slowing down the machinations of Congress, especially after the last 4 years of glacial, if any, movement in Congress. So anyway, that's very interesting that a whole slew of acts are being proposed to do just that. Now, this is sort of in the same vein, but is there anything that you want to add about the Regulatory Accountability Act?
Well, I think the Regulatory Accountability Act is often sort of described as the more moderate regulatory reform. I think, you know, the Midnight Rule Relief Act and the Reins Act are generally seen as a bit extreme. But what we would say at Public Citizen is the Regulatory Accountability Act is not moderate. It's actually just as extreme. So let me give you a few points about what the Regulatory Accountability Act would do. First, it would add about 70 extra procedural requirements to each major regulation. So procedural requirements would be like a cost-benefit analysis, hearings, a comment period, things like that. Now, presently, it's estimated that these rules already have about 110 procedural requirements, right? So if you add another 70 onto that. And what that would mean basically is that regulations that already sometimes take between 4 and 8 years, it's estimated this add about another 2 to 4 years of regulation, of time until a regulation can be finalized. So again, it would really render the government very ineffective. So let's say we have something, we find out about a new toxin in our water supply, right? We may want to move forward and go ahead and create a regulation to sort of protect our environment if we have a situation like Flint, Michigan with lead. Now, what things like the Regulatory Accountability Act will do will add so much time and so many more procedural requirements to regulations that it will take years and years and years, maybe a decade in some cases, to get these regulations out. And what will happen is by the time you get the regulation out, what is the damage that will be done? If we know that something is wrong, if we know that there's a new toxin in our food supply or something like that, the idea that we're going to be slowing down to a crawl to get this stuff out is just it's malpractice. And also, the other thing that the Regulatory Accountability Act does is it requires that agencies take in all low-cost possible solutions to the issue they're trying to solve. Now, on the surface, that might sound good to people, right? Lowest cost, the lowest cost regulation on business. Now, when you think about it, though, is the lowest cost always the best solution? Now, let's say if we want to talk about something like regulating asbestos, right? What the Regulatory Accountability Act requires agencies to do is take proposals from the entities that they're regulating about what is a possible solution to this problem. Now, the lowest cost solution to dealing with asbestos, what if a corporation proposed, oh, we'll just put up signs, right? We'll put up signs that there's asbestos here. That is definitely the lowest cost, no doubt. It'll be pretty cheap for them to enact that. But do we really think that's the best solution? So what the Regulatory Accountability Act does, along with slowing down the entire process, is it creates an unworkable situation where they have to focus so much on the cost to business with these regulations, but don't focus on the benefit at all. And in many of these regulations, you know, you take like one of the first regulations or that people talk about so much, the seatbelts in cars, right? What's the cost of that? Well, it cost every manufacturer to put seatbelts in cars. That's true. But how many lives did we save? So the idea that agencies won't be focusing on the benefits of these rules and are just trying to find the cheapest solution, it really does not bode well for protecting the health and safety in our environment, that they're going to be focused so much about finding a cheap option and not necessarily the right option. So it's really all of these different regulatory measures, anti-regulatory measures, are really, really troubling. And the Regulatory Accountability Act, while it's often claimed to be moderate, is anything but moderate. And it's actually sort of the culmination of all of these extreme anti-regulatory bills.
Before we open the phone lines, I would like us also to talk about the Cardin-Lugar provision of the 2010 Dodd-Frank Financial Reform and Consumer Protection Act. What can you tell us about that?
Well, that it's really bizarre that that is something that they're looking to get rid of. It's basically something that was put in place to prevent bribery. So what it does, the provision, it requires companies disclose when they make payments to foreign governments, oil and gas companies. So the real intent of that is to prevent bribery. We don't want our corporations, you know, bribing foreign governments for things like land deals and different things like that. So why that is something that they would focus on, I have no idea. It's really an anti-bribery measure that I think any person, regardless of political leanings, would think is reasonable, that these corporations would have to alert our government if they're going to be making payments to a foreign government. But why they wanted to look at that, I don't know. It's probably similar to the thought process of getting rid of the office, the OCE in the House that sort of blew up in the beginning of the Trump administration. I don't really know why they'd be going after ethics rules, the things that prevent bribery, but that seems to be the course they're taking.
Well, ethics rules seem to have been pretty much thrown upside down, if not out the window entirely. Starting at the very top with President Trump himself taking his belief that the president is exempt from conflict of interest regulations and that sort of thing, seemingly ignoring the constitutional preventions in the Emoluments Clause. And the shady back and forth around lobbying concerns. Do you have any thoughts on that, Mike Tanglis?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing about his business, what he did is really sort of for show only. It's somewhat useless. The only way he could really, cure any fears about that would be to sell off his business and divest. But the idea of him just handing it off to his sons, Donald Trump knows what he owns. He was obviously there for a very long time. We don't know everything that he owns because he never released his tax returns, but just sort of passing it off to your sons is really just sort of a symbolic waste of time, I think, in terms of actually preventing corruption. And if you look at last night, he had that the announcement of a Supreme Court nominee. Both of his sons were there. Both of his sons were chatting with senators and things like that. So the idea that he's not going to know what's going on, or that and the only way we could ever be sure that in the back of his mind he wasn't thinking about a business is if he actually divested and he did nothing close.
Well, we already have a caller on the line who wants to join our conversation. And as soon as she drops off, listeners, you may also call in at 707-895-2448. Let's take this call. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning. I don't mean to be disrespectful. My first question is he Canadian? And about Betsy Voss, she doesn't present very well, but she knows what she's talking about. Thank you.
So your question is he Canadian? Mike, would you like to answer
that? Well, I live in D.C. now. I'm originally from Massachusetts, so maybe that's the accent that she was hearing, but no, I'm not Canadian.
Okay. So if you want to join our conversation with Mike Tanglis, give us a call at 707-895-2448, and you may do so. About the Betsy DeVos nomination. First of all, do you have any comments? I know it's not typically the purview of a public citizen, but perhaps you wish to say something.
Sure. In terms of not presenting well, I'll have to respectfully disagree with the caller in the sense that, you know, she didn't do well in the hearings, and it seemed like she didn't prepare. If you're going to be in charge of education policy in the United States of America, and you're going to get a hearing in front of senators, it's a pretty basic ask to say you should review the material. So the idea that she went into that hearing not knowing about multiple issues in federal law and things like that is really very troubling. And the other thing I would say is she has a specific issue area where she has knowledge, but it's not public education. It's actually privatizing public education. So much of her focus has been on charter schools and the privatization of public schools. So it's very understandable that people have concerns about her running public schools when she actually has no experience running public schools and has even shown a desire to do away with public schools and focus mainly on privatization of schools.
Yes, and I would, well, we do have other callers. Let's take these calls. Good morning, caller. You're on the air.
Hello. The Tom Hartman program is on at 5 o'clock on weekdays on this very same program. And Tom Hartman is a professor and a politician and a extremely well-informed person. If you've ever listened to him, you'll be extremely impressed. His concern is that the fool at the, you know, the emperor has no clothes is a better representation of what we've come to in the United States in Trump, is that if his Vice President Pence and Ryan, who is basically the head of the party now in the House of Representatives, if they get in, we throw Trump out. That will be exactly what the Republicans want. You may be aware that in the Atlantic, there is an article by the best reporter yet, who fellows that the effort to take over the Republican Party is to create chaos enough to the point that whenever Trump is making absurd gestures, the Republican Party must go along with him because they want him to not stop their agenda, i.e. no Medicare, no the IRS not looking into the billionaires, and the things that will basically send our country down the tubes. They will have to go along with him because they have their own agenda. The Goebbels, the Hitler, behind the whole project, according to Tom Hartman, over the weeks.
Okay, thank you for that suggestion that people tune in to Tom Hartman. I appreciate that very much. And if you don't want to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, you can use the jukebox function to check out the show. We just lost a caller who had been patiently waiting. Please call back in and we'll put you on. Okay, thank you. Good morning, caller. You are on the air. Do you have a question for Mike Tanglis?
Oh, is it my turn?
Yes, it is. You're on the
air. Okay. I just wanted to first add that the caller that asked if Mike was Canadian and then added that DeVos is knows what she's talking about. So it's proof that, you know, she that we have a lot of people that are uneducated, and everything that Mike has said is 120% true. Sorry, I have some background noise, but I have never listened to so much radio news in my life since, you know, the latest presidency. So I just wanted to make a comment that Mike is someone I align with. So, okay, if anybody's listening
okay.
and they feel otherwise, then they're probably wrong.
Well, thank you for those comments. Mike, okay. Do you have any other comment? All right, you can join our conversation at 707-895-2448. Let's try to be respectful as much as possible without name calling and that sort of thing. I really would insist on that. Thank you, caller. You are on the air. What is your question for Mike Tanglis?
Hi, good morning. I was wondering about what he has, his opinion of Jeff Sessions and his chance of being held up.
Very good. Well, let's let him respond. Thank you for that call.
Sure. I think, to me, you know, Jeff Sessions, on the surface, when you think about the fact that in 1986, there was a lot of concern about him, and they didn't think that he was ready for the position, federal judge, because of sort of racist things that he had said in the past or things that he had been accused of. The idea that now in 2016 he should be running the Department of Justice, I think it rubs people the wrong way. You know, I personally can say that I worked with some of, at least one of the attorneys, he's actually a mentor of mine, who filed some of those cases that Jeff Sessions said he was on. And I've talked to that attorney personally since then. And it does seem that, you know, they asked Jeff Sessions to give his top 10 cases, right? And we find out now that four of those cases that he described as sort of his top 10 big cases that he's done in his life, he didn't really work on. And they were all civil rights cases. He was advising on them, but he wasn't deeply involved, because we have the attorneys who were deeply involved at the DOJ, one of them whom I know, who worked on that, and essentially said he signed papers for us, but he was not deeply involved in these civil rights cases. So that sort of overcompensation, I think, is pretty telling. If you're an attorney, you know, Jeff Sessions is an older man. I think he's in, I'm not exactly sure how long, but he's been practicing law for quite some time. He was an attorney general. And if he's going to point out his top 10 cases, and four of them we find that he's really just been embellishing what he did on them and that he wasn't really deeply involved, almost half of his top cases, that's really troubling. The second part of your question about whether or not he's going to pass, it's a good question. I think at this point it looks like he likely will. He just came out of committee today, I think 11-9. That wasn't too long ago. There's so much going on. It does look like he'll be approved, and there's a lot of things that you know, we don't know where he stands on Trump's immigration ban. We don't know all these things. We don't know how he'll enforce the law. There's also been talk about Jeff Sessions. He's not sure if he's going to keep every consent decree with the different law enforcement agencies around the country. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you have things like, there was a study in Ferguson, there was a study in Baltimore and in Cleveland, where the police agency has been found to have a pattern of different practices that are really against sort of civil rights and have been targeted as sort of racist practices within the police department. They agree with the Department of Justice to enact these changes in order to sort of come up to speed. And he's kind of dodged a few times about whether he's going to follow through on that. And I think for a lot of people, that's really troubling. You know, some of the people they've put in place now, you know, you look at the DOJ has been fighting certain voter ID and voter suppression efforts around the country. They've been on the side of people suing the different governments. It looks like they'll flip, and they may actually go to the other side and argue against the place that the DOJ was arguing just months ago. So it's really likely to represent a drastic change in sort of the efforts of the DOJ. And so all of that included, you know, it does not seem like he's the right fit to run this agency in 2016, but it does look as if he'll likely be confirmed.
We have time to take one more call. Let's take that call now. Good morning, caller. You're on the air. Please be brief.
Charter schools are public schools.
Well, it sounds like you have already had a call. Is there one more person who is waiting to be on the line? We can take that very quickly. Hello, caller.
Now?
You're on the air. Please be very brief.
Okay, a very quick question about Tom Price. I would like a few more details about his insider trading there, if you could.
Thank you very much. Mike, can you give us a little bit more detail on Tom Price, inside trader?
Yeah, absolutely. There was there's a few reports. There's one in the Wall Street Journal that's very recent. I don't know the exact title of it, but if you Google Wall Street Journal and then the Tom Price insider trading, there's also been a few CNN reports. It's basically there have been at least two specific trades that he's made. One that he made recently where he got a 12% discount on the stock. It was offered to him, another congressman, and then that congressman's chief of staff. And then weeks after he proposed legislation to help that same company that he had bought from, a lot of his healthcare trades have been scrutinized. So I would, if you look it up online, I think CNN has a few good reports, the Washington Post has a couple, and the Wall Street Journal has a recent one that really lead one to believe that there could certainly be some issues there. And I think that as an organization, we've requested an investigation into these for possible insider trading.
Okay, Mike, 30 seconds for some final words before we have to say goodbye.
Well, first, I really want to appreciate you having me on today. I've really enjoyed it. I think, as we touched on earlier today, I would encourage people to stay involved, regardless of what side you're on. You know, there's a lot going on right now. There's going to be a lot of changes in the next few weeks and the coming months. It's important for every voter to stay involved. That way, you know, you can figure out who you want to support and things like that. So I would just encourage everyone that there are a lot of changes going on right now, and you should definitely stay up to date and read everything that you can to figure out exactly what's going on and think about the certain issues you may be passionate about and want to get involved in.
Well, we very much appreciate your coming on today, especially with such short notice, to keep us abreast of the very rapidly changing situation. Mike Tanglis, thank you so much for joining us today on Forthright Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Our guest today on Forthright Radio has been Michael Tanglis, a researcher with Public Citizen. You can find more by going to publiccitizen.org. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production, broadcast each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYX and Z, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Engineer Rich Culbertson. I'm Joy LeClaire. You can contact us by emailing forthrightradio@gmail.com.